Come and go to that land. Come and go to that land. Come and go to that land where I'm bound, where I'm bound. Come and go to that land. Come and go to that land. Come and go to that land where I'm bound. I have a mother in that land. I have a mother in that land. I have a mother in that land where I'm bound, where I'm bound. I have a mother in that land. I have a mother in that land. I have a mother in that land where I'm bound. So don't you wanna go to that land? Don't you wanna go to that land? Don't you wanna go to that land where I'm bound, where I'm bound? Don't you wanna go to that land? Don't you wanna go to that land? Come and go to that land where I'm bound. Amen. You all sound great. My grandmother and my grandfather and my great-grandmother and my great-aunts and all my play aunties and play mamas would tap their foot on wooden floors in rural Georgia and in the woods of Ohio outside of Cleveland, singing that song during devotional. And it was a reminder to me when they sang that song that I came from a people, and that those people knew their own people and knew their people's story. And I knew that at a very basic level, the song they were singing was about their love for their elders, their love for their ancestors long gone, but whose lives and whose witness still had power in their lives. And they were singing about a life beyond this one and the joy that they would have in that land where their ancestors have gathered. But I also knew at the same time that the song they were singing was not just about some time beyond this one, but it was about this moment, the moment we're in right now. And that the journey and the yearning that they had was not just for something that would happen after they died, but that could happen even in their own lifetime. When I say they tapped their feet on wooden floors in rural Georgia and in the wooded suburbs of Ohio, it's because they were already people who were bound for other lands as participants in the great migration of African Americans, of those 6 million black people who defected from the South to get away from Jim and Jane Crow. They were already trying to live into this notion of being bound for a better land, a promised land, a land of opportunity. And so when they sang that song, they weren't just hoping for life after death, but they were praying prayers for me and for my children and grandchildren, that we would have hope, that we would have life and life in its fullness. And so I started with that song, one, to center my own self, but one, to be reminded of who I am and who I come from. So I thank you, Jackie, again, for inviting me to be a part of this this piece, part of this conference, and to share this morning. I have been blown away by what I've experienced here. So I met Jackie, of course, last year in June at the Mountaintop Experience, and then heard about her church, and actually I'd heard about the church before, and then started streaming the worship service online because I get up really early. And so at 8 o'clock in the morning on Sunday in California, I can watch East Coast worship services, right? And so, you know, I'm familiar with that camera over there because that's my vantage point to, you know. And I've been staring at some of you, and some of you probably think that I'm kind of creepy because I've been staring at you. So I'm trying to remember where I met you, but I didn't meet you. I've just seen you up here on my computer screen. So it's a real honor to be here. And I feel like I'm, you know, standing on the shoulders of giants, not only the ones who came before me and who were part of my life, but just giants in this conference, in this space. I've learned so much from what has been shared so far. And in some ways, I was telling someone yesterday, I'm just going to get up and say what everybody else said, that. Amen. But I will endeavor today to share with you a bit about some of the connections between what we've been talking about and the work of organizing. I don't think I've turned this on to see if it's even going to work. So we can go to the next slide. I'll just have to turn a lot and deal with that. So I want to talk with you about organizing and imagination as a resource for fueling the struggle for economic justice, racial and economic justice and healing in our country. And the agenda, go to the next one. The agenda will be one to try to make the case that organizing that's fueled by a hope-filled imagination is essential for building the movement for racial and economic justice and healing. I want to talk a little bit about what organizing is, and then I want to talk about the value of organizing for communities and congregations, and then I want to talk about the notion of hope and imagination as a part of the organizing process. So that's what we'll try to get done in the time that we have. And there'll be some moments for us to stop for some conversation throughout the presentation. Is that all right? So I work for PICO National Network. PICO is a over 40-year-old network of organizations in over 200 cities and towns around the country, over 20 states. And I work with PICO as the director of clergy organizing. I've been involved in PICO as a leader since 1996, the year before my son was born. So that means I've been involved in organizing for 18 years, because my son will be 17 next month. And I've been on the staff of PICO for the past 6 years. I'm the director of clergy organizing, and I coordinate and lead all of our efforts to invest in the formation of clergy and congregations that are engaged in our work. And it's a real joy. I was telling my partner, Lainey, that part of the fullness and abundance in my life is being able to have a job where I'm really doing what I want to do. I'm really grateful for it. So let's talk about organizing. Before we go to the next slide, let me just see if there's a couple of people that can tell me how they describe community organizing to their partner. Yes, sir. Teaching people how to act together and fighting against the individualism that has taken over our politics and culture. That's beautiful. Yes, my sister way in the back. Is a group of people doing what?
Eating.
A group of people eating. That's lovely. We do a lot of feasting and organizing. Indeed. A couple of others, yes.
People coming together for a common cause.
People coming together for a common cause. Maybe Jim, you should choose the people, because then by the time you get to them, they've said it. A couple of others. Jim, why don't you choose? I see one in the back.
I just have an image of Ella Baker, who's one of my heroes of organizing grassroots. I'm trying to avoid like the perils of her message seems to be the perils of leaders who actually, you know, people then accede their power to the leaders and they forget that they are actually the ones that have the power.
That's beautiful.
And so it's Ella Baker.
That's beautiful. If you didn't hear, she talked about Ella Baker. Ella Baker being a central image that came to mind for her.
It's always been, for me, aligning with the bigger story of the vision.
Aligning the bigger story.
Aligns.
Everyone aligns around
them. The alignment of the bigger story of mm-hmm. what you are envisioning.
It's beautiful. Thank you. This will be the last one. We'll keep going.
Helping people learn what it is they love and how to get more of it.
That's good. I love that definition. Helping people figure out what they love and get more. So let's go to the next slide. Here's a working definition, very wooden. And I try not to sound this wooden when people ask me what organizing is, but when I talk about organizing, particularly faith-based organizing that's not only based in faith institutions, but is actually informed by the faith traditions and practices of those faith, is an approach to social problems that develops leaders, one, and builds organizations that have power, that can analyze and understand their problems, and then that can create policy solutions, innovative policy solutions to address those problems that will bring deep change, deep systemic change. You should know that you'll get all of these slides, so if writing is helpful for you, as it often is for me, please continue to write, but if you're worried about capturing everything, you will get these slides. So I like to think about organizing also within the continuum of ways that people respond to social problems. We go to the next slide. Robert Franklin, the president emeritus of Morehouse College, wrote a book a long time ago, Another Day's Journey. He talked about a variety of ways that congregations respond to social problems. And I like his template here because I think that it helps to place organizing within a broad range of ways that faith communities respond to social problems. So he talks about charity and mercy ministries that are about providing immediate and direct relief to folks in need. Talks about those ministries that are sustaining support to folks, like recovery programs and counseling programs, those direct service programs that we're very familiar with. And then he talks about political advocacy, where churches are representing the needs of the needy and the marginalized, and then community transformation, where the church sees itself as a partner in the comprehensive revitalization of the community. And I think, if you go to the next slide, that organizing really lives at the intersection of political advocacy and community transformation. Because there is an element of advocacy in the work. Congregations are working around their own self-interest, their own clear needs, but they're also standing with others in the community who are suffering as well. But it's not just advocacy in the public space. It's really about transforming the community and transforming lives of people. So I used to argue that organizing was not advocacy. But the reality is once you begin to move into realms of organizing that are across cities and across states and across the country, you know, when I go to Washington, D.C., I'm carrying 1,000 or 2,000 stories with me. I'm advocating. Right, and so I'm not going to try to be a purist about organizing because a lot of it fly 10,000 people to D.C. so we could say we're actually organizing. Because organizing, in its purest sense, is about the people who are most impacted by the pain being the ones who are bringing the voices to bear. They're not advocates; they are the voices. They're not relying only on other people to speak for them, but they're speaking for themselves. Does that distinction make sense? I just want to be honest that there is an element of advocacy in it. So there's this community transformation piece, but there's also an element of advocacy in it as well. If we go to the next slide. So PICO is part of a broader field. There are a lot of groups that do organizing, a lot of local organizations in cities and towns all around the country and around the world that are involved in some form of organizing. PICO is one of four big faith-based networks, and some of you probably heard of these other groups as well, in addition to PICO. IAF, which is like the mother institution, which was
founded in Chicago, has a number of organizations all around the country. The Gamaliel Foundation, also based in Chicago. The work that our president was a part of and his organizing career was really sort of funded and supported through the Gamaliel Foundation. DART, the Direct Action Research Training Institute, or Center, is based in Florida. They have lots of work in the Midwest and sort of down from Michigan into Florida area. PICO was founded in 1972 by a Jesuit priest named John Bauman. He was the executive director until 2009 when he stepped down to become the director of special projects and actually leads our work in Rwanda, Haiti, and Central America. And so John hates for people to say that he's retired because he's tired. He's just tired. He's not retired. He's very busy continuing the work that he helped to birth in Oakland that became a national movement and really support international partners around the world who want to bring this kind of work to their own communities and other places around the world. So if we go to the next slide, this is just a map I got from some folks who've been studying the field of institution-based, faith-based organizing. And I'm just going to give you a sense on the map of where these big networks are. The first four are IAF, PICO, Gamaliel, and DART, the pink, the green, the, I don't know, burgundy and gold or something. Those are places where you'll find our work. And then there's always work growing. If you go to the next slide, you'll see a bit of where PICO is right now. And at the same time, there are states where we're building some work, particularly in Arizona, Utah, Texas, Georgia, Maryland, and Maine. So there's fledgling projects that are starting in places there. And then we also find ourselves collaborating with partners from the other networks as well, which is a real development over time. We used to fight over turf, and frankly, sometimes still do. But finding ways to figure out what it means to partner together across the field has been a really important development for us. PICO works on a lot of different kinds of issues. When you talk about our work at the local level, I live in San Jose, California. When I first got getting involved in the work, we were busy trying to get an ordinance passed in our county that would create a pathway for every child in our county to have access to healthcare, regardless of their income or immigration status. We were also working on a big campaign to support renters who were being kicked out of their homes because the dot-com bubble had not yet burst, and so people were still figuring out how to get rid of folks so they could jack up prices and have all these rich kids from all over the country who were getting involved in high tech pay a lot more money for rent. You'll find local campaigns happening in PICO, but you'll also find that there are campaigns happening in the life of the network that have statewide significance and that have national significance. There are really four campaigns that have sort of a national scope to them within PICO. One of them is a campaign that grew out of our work in healthcare. PICO really kind of made its name on the national scene through our work fighting for the reauthorization of the state children's health insurance program with more money to cover more kids. And that actually was inspired by the work that I just described in San Jose. That became the inspiration for a national movement to make sure more kids around the country had access to health care. That sort of set the stage for us to be involved in the whole fight over ACA and Obamacare, ensuring that there was an affordability standard in that legislation. And so the campaign we have now related to healthcare is about the implementation of ACA and ensuring that the resources that we dreamed of in that legislation actually meet the people closest to the pain in the communities. Another campaign that we have is one we call our Economic Dignity Campaign that is largely driven, and inspired by the foreclosure crisis and had a lot of our leaders around the country mobilizing and really engaging the banking institutions as well as our government officials around modifying loans and paying attention to how we hold banks accountable. We call that our economic dignity campaign. It now has become a campaign that's largely about living wage fights all around the country, as well as continued work around holding banks accountable, particularly as it relates to payday loans. The two biggest campaigns happening nationally in PICO, if we can go to the next slide, are the Campaign for Citizenship, which we thought was a campaign we would have folded already. We thought last year was the year to get immigration taken care of. And this Campaign for Citizenship was to ensure that 11 million immigrants in this country had access to a pathway to citizenship. That campaign continues, obviously, given what happened or what did not happen last year. But it's the campaign that involves the greatest number of our federations. There's about 60 PICO federations in PICO, and a good 40 of them are involved in some way in the campaign for citizenship in a number of key states, about 15 states around the country. The other really big campaign that we're putting a lot of energy into, the next slide, is our Lifelines to Healing campaign. And this is the campaign through which Middle Church and Jackie have had an opportunity to connect to PICO's work as well. This campaign grew out of the deep pain expressed by a number of African American clergy, starting in the Bay Area and then growing around the country around the crisis around gun violence and around mass incarceration. And so this campaign has been growing quite a bit, and we have a vision this year of training 25,000 leaders. These are not just clergy and congregation members, but formerly incarcerated folks and their families, training them, preparing to really build a powerful base of people that will do some work with us over the next couple of years to dismantle mass incarceration and reduce gun violence in our communities around the country. And we call that campaign Lifelines to Healing. We often will have every quarter a gun violence Sabbath where congregations are focusing on the crisis around gun violence and the need to be engaged in fights to ensure that we are promoting gun safety in our legislation and our laws. And so I want to thank Middle Church and Jackie for participating in that. I said that PICO is made up of 60 federations. A federation is a local organization, a federation of congregations in a local city or community that have decided they want to build power together. So there's a federation here in New York called Faith in New York. It's actually a newer organization here in New York that was born out of the birth of the merging of some of our efforts in different boroughs, particularly in Queens and in Brooklyn. And I'm not sure how many congregations are a part of Faith in New York, but typically there are anywhere from 30 to 100 congregations in any given city that are a part of a particular local federation in PICO. So I'm gonna pause in a minute here just to see if there are some basic questions that people have about PICO or organizing, and then I'm gonna get into how organizing operates, how it happens, what the process looks like. Yes. So the question was, where am I based? I live in San Jose, California. PICO's corporate office is in Oakland, where the founder is. That's where all of our business is taken care of. We have an office to support all of our organizations. We call it organizational support. It's based in San Diego, largely because the executive director of PICO is in San Diego.
This church, in what capacity?
I'm sorry?
Okay,
I'll get to that in a second. So then, and then we have an office in Washington, D.C. that is a policy office that supports our national work. So when I say that I'm working with Jackie, what I'm really saying is that Jackie and Middle Church partnered with Faith in New York and the Lifelines to Healing campaign nationally when we had a big gun violence Sabbath. So this was a congregation that was involved in lifting up that work and preaching and teaching about the need for people of faith to pay attention to what's happening in our communities around gun violence and to understand the power that they can build to actually make real change, to pass laws and legislation in our cities and in our states that ensure that there's gun safety and that there's a reduction in violence in our communities. Got a hand up in the back there.
I have a basic question about organizing, more of a push or pull type of a thing. So when do you know that an organization or community or topic is right for organizing? Do you typically, as an advocate, go in and organize people to begin this, or do the communities come to you? So is it more of a push, or is it more of a pull, or is it topic specific?
Good. So why don't we go to the next slides? I think this will take us right into the organizing process. So let's skip that. Let's go to the next one. Yeah, there we go. So 17 years ago, I would have said to you that the way that we choose issues in PICO is that those decisions are made at the grassroots level, that congregations and communities engage in a series of one-to-one conversations in their community, gathering and understanding what the needs of the community are, and that those folks in the community, after gathering all of that data and feedback, come together in an assembly like this and report out what they've heard and make decisions together about what issues they're going to prioritize in their local organization and community for the year. And then they'll move through this process of after having one-to-ones, going into a season of research around issues that are important to them, or whatever issue they've chosen is going to be their primary issue, doing research around those issues, building relationships with decision makers, building power, generating and growing a base of people in their city to be a part of the struggle with them, and then moving into direct action where they are confronting the powers in their community to actually adopt innovative policy solutions that will make real change, and then celebrating that together. That's the whole cycle of organizing. Okay, that's the cycle of activity that's involved in organizing. You'll see that I added story of self, story of us, story of now, to try to link Valerie's presentation to this, because what Valerie taught you is a layer of the work that we're involved in. So I really appreciated that she covered that so nicely for us. So to answer the question more fully, in a context now where, particularly in PICO, where we are not only doing work at the local level, because for years we were founded as an institute that simply trained people. Like, people didn't know who PICO was. You knew what Faith in New York was. You might have known what Oakland Community Organizations was in Oakland, California. You might know what the Essex County Community Organization is in Essex County, Massachusetts. And the people that organization sent you to some place with some people called PICO, and they taught you all this stuff. And then you went back home and did your thing that you decided you would do at home. Once we began to discern the need to develop power and build power at the state level so that organizations across the state of Massachusetts or California or Louisiana could engage the state house because the policies that they needed to address were really state policies, or the money they needed to really have allocated was really state money, that meant then that the opportunity for there to be more push and pull increased. And then once we move to the national level, like that's the dilemma we live in now, this tension between what we understand is happening from our vantage point in Washington, D.C., what we see as political opportunities for us to step into some organizing work, versus what might be happening on the ground. And organizations locally have to make decisions. So when I told you that there are so many federations or so many states that are involved in our campaign for citizenship, that's because only those federations and states that were clear that this was their priority actually participated in that campaign. So folks have to be clear about what priorities are and have to be able to say no to PICO. And PICO may have a view that we really need Maryland in this fight, right? Because like the senator from Maryland is like on this such and such a committee. And so there's always this negotiation that happens. And I mean, to tell the truth, it's not like it's a tension that we want to be healthy. It's not always healthy. But the reality is that there is a push and pull, and decisions are made both on the ground and in the broader field as well. And there's a real negotiation that has to happen there. Let's go to the next slide. I'm going to run out of time here. Let's go to the next slide. I'll say a little bit about organizing and congregational development. So I fell in love with organizing not just because it was an effective way for congregations to be in relationship with community and to really be about creating real change in their community, but I fell in love with organizing as a pastor. I fell in love with organizing because I saw in organizing the resources to really help me be a good pastor and to help my congregation be a stronger community. And so when I enrolled in a DMIN program, and my plan was I was going to write a dissertation on the value of organizing for congregations. Then I did my research and found out a whole bunch of folk already said that. And so I'm writing about something else, but and related. But one of the people who said that is Rich Wood, who wrote the book Faith in Action, and who, along with Marianne Flaherty, was a part of this study on the power of organizing to help in the development of congregations. And they sort of outlined some of the value of organizing for congregations, including relationality, building social capital within congregations. People tend to get to know each other better through the process of learning how to do really powerful one-to-ones and really, really deep relational one-to-ones. People become stronger leaders because they begin to understand who they are, not only in the world, but even in their own institutions. And so they gain skills for running meetings more efficiently, and just really understanding the power of their own voice. And so you'll find that people involved in this work become stronger leaders in your congregations as well. People make linkages to their faith. We talked about mystery yesterday with Dr. Borg. There is a way in which people begin to make connections between how their faith is connected to their public life, about how who they are as people of faith is wrapped up in this understanding of the greater world they're trying to make, and that their faith is not just about their own personal spirituality, but about something much greater than who they are. And then the congregations build a kind of public presence that really gives them the credibility to speak in the public spaces about all kinds of issues. Okay, all right, great. Thank you. So let's go to the next slide. So with that in mind, with the benefits of organizing in mind, I want to talk a little bit about imagination. And this is actually what I'm trying to write about in this dissertation that should have been done a long time ago. is that I've tried to make the case to a lot of people in PICO, pastors that I work with, that organizing can have all the benefits that I described in the previous slide, and that organizing can then inform a lot of how your congregation lives in the world. So for me, organizing informed worship. Worship changed when my congregation got deeply involved in organizing. Because what we were experiencing in the world was informing what we talked about in our worship space, and what we prayed about in our worship space, and what we celebrated, and what we were actually trying to do in that time of worship. It informed spiritual formation and education. It informed leadership development and administration. It informed our mission partnerships and congregational care. Like, what kind of healing were we really after in all of this? And what I feel organizing actually did for me was it actually fueled my own imagination as a pastor and fueled the imagination of my congregation. So if you go to the next slide, I love that slide, but we're going to skip it. Let's go to the next slide. I think that it's important to understand that organizing can have the power to really spark and inform the imagination of pastors and clergy who are leading faith communities. Craig Dykstra, a practical theologian who I think used to run the Lilly Endowment, writes about this in describing some of the congregations that Lilly was studying through their programs around pastoral excellence. He talks about imagination as sort of a way of seeing things, a way of seeing and interpreting that shapes what the pastor thinks and does, and how she responds to people in gestures, words, and actions. It functions as a kind of internal gyroscope guiding pastors in and through every crevice of pastoral life and work. It emerges over time and is influenced by many forces. And when I read that, I began to think about organizing as a force that really feeds and informs that internal gyroscope of a pastor. It's fun to watch Jackie from that camera move around this congregation, sit right here and turn around and tell people things in the middle of service. There's just a sense, there's a way in which you know that Jackie's been here long enough and the clergy on the staff have been here long enough, they kind of understand their people and how things flow and how to make connections. I even saw that happen during this conference where members were raising hands and asking questions, and Jackie like understood what that person was really asking and kind of spoke into that. That's what I'm talking about. And organizing, the kinds of stories that are unearthed in the organizing process deeply inform a pastor in terms of understanding the real pain and the real joy in their communities and in their congregations. Also, I think that congregations have their imaginations awakened through the process of organizing. And Craig Dykstra has some things to say about that on the next slide. You can go to the next slide, but I'm going to skip it and keep going. Lastly, I want to talk about imagination through the lens of what Walter Brueggemann talks about when he writes all the 7 million books he's been writing about prophetic imagination. I heard him introduced once, and they said Walter Brueggemann has written, 3,015 books or something like that. Everybody laughed, and he said, "His next book is coming out in 15 minutes." he's quite prolific. I really appreciate the value of his mind and his thinking. It's really informed a lot of our clergy within the PICO network, and we really value him. But we're really clear that when we talk about an imagination that is prophetic, it's an imagination that is so big that it can utter, entertain, describe, and construe a world other than the one that is manifest in front of us. So how do we engage in an imagination that's bigger than our given reality? How do we not, in the way that Lynn was talking about it with us in the previous hour, just take the world as it is and accept it as it is, that there actually is something more and that we can actually be about that something more. Go to the next slide. So, quick story, an example of this for me. 7 Easters ago, when I was still in the pulpit pastoring before I started working full-time for PICO, we were preparing for, Easter Sunday, the big Sunday when everybody comes to church, where the lilies are out, making me sneeze, but looking beautiful, banners are up, the choirs are well-rehearsed, and the pastor's written the best sermon ever. And if the pastor delivers on this sermon, then all the visitors will be like, "Why don't we come every Sunday?" And they come up and they join, and the church grows, and it's just like 1950 again, right? At least that's the illusion, right, that I was operating with, or maybe it was the imagination I was operating with. 7 Easters ago, preparing for Easter Sunday morning service. On Easter Sunday morning, that Sunday morning was also supposed to be the day that we were going to launch our local congregation's organizing campaign that we decided for ourselves. PICO didn't tell us, nor did our San Jose organization tell us, but we decided we were going to sponsor a campaign to support safety for adults living with mental illness in our community. Because our church was the site that provides therapeutic and recreational services to over 150 adults every day who live with mental illness. And we were aware of their challenges through our organizing process, and we're engaged in a campaign to get more dollars into from our mental health department into our law enforcement to support officers being trained in an approach called crisis intervention training that helped them understand what might be happening to someone who's having a psychotic episode, someone who's having a bad day who might be off their meds, and so that instead of shooting first and asking questions later, they might have more tools besides guns and tasers to actually help and serve and protect people. So that was the vision. And so we decided we were going to have a big meeting with all of the decision makers in town on Pentecost Sunday and to prepare the congregation and community for that, we were going to start on Easter Sunday a whole sermon series and education series that help people understand mental illness, mental health, law enforcement, all of these things, so that by the time we got to Pentecost, we'd have this big, massive action of people who are deeply informed and ready to champion this issue. So Easter was also important for that reason. Well, it was on that Easter Sunday morning that Antonio walked into the sanctuary. Antonio's not his real name. Antonio walked into the sanctuary, and I recognized him when he walked in. He was someone I'd seen before. I've seen him as a member of the community center that was housed on our campus that provided these recreation and therapeutic services to adults living with mental illness. I'd seen him walking down the hallways of the church. In fact, one time I heard him outside of my office, and I thought there were five people outside of my office because he speaks in many different voices and giggles a lot, and he can make it sound like there's a whole conversation going on with a lot of different people. And I opened up the door, and it's just him. And I said, I wonder if he's going to, like, start talking while we're trying to do Easter Sunday morning service. And I wonder how this is going to go. Well, sure enough, as soon as I get up to preach the most brilliant sermon I've ever written, Antonio begins to speak. And he speaks. And then Antonio's other friend speaks, and his other friend speaks. And Antonio's laughing, and he's having a conversation. And he's about where Christina's sitting there in the back. And my usher, who's standing at the door, walks over to him and begins to tap him on the shoulder. Antonio's Latino, and my usher is African-American. He begins to tap on Antonio's shoulder and explain to him that he's going to have to take his conversation outside. He's welcome to come back when he's done, but he'll have to step outside. Antonio's not really listening to him, not really aware of him. And when he finally is, he looks at him and he says, "Get your hands off me, nigga!" All this happening while I'm talking and giving this great, brilliant sermon. So, of course, I stopped, and there was silence, and there was gasping. And I looked at Antonio, I looked at my usher, and I said, "It's okay. It's okay. Let him be. He's not bothering me." And then my wife looked at me like, "He's bothering us." But eventually, my usher was able to escort Antonio out into the narthex, where he continued to have his conversation. But by then, like, the damage was done, right? I had to figure out how to get back into the sermon, see if there was some clever way to incorporate what happened, and that wasn't working. And people were clearly disturbed. And all of the desired demographic in the room, you know, the families that came that day that normally didn't come, the students from the university across the street that normally didn't come, you could tell they were, like, really disoriented. And in fact, two students got up and walked out, and you could hear their conversation in the narthex. "Oh my God, can you believe that happened?" After service, it was clear that the leadership was very upset about this. They asked me to huddle with them, and they said there were two sentiments in that huddle. One was, "That can never happen again." The other sentiment was, "I hope that young man knows he's welcome in our church." And what was beautiful about it was that those sentiments often lived, like, in the same person. I mean, there were a few people who, like, championed only one or the other. But for the most part, that was, and the spirit of that conversation then grew into this notion of, so what are we going to do about this? What are we going to do about this? Well, first of all, what are we going to do about the talking man? It can't be like the rubric for this conversation. What are we going to do about Antonio? His name is Antonio. He has a name. He's not the talking man. Who in the congregation knows him? How can we engage him? How can we let him know that he's always welcome to come back? And how can we also help him understand boundaries and how we're going to support him in those boundaries? And so we launched a plan, and the next Sunday he was welcomed. And people sat with him. If he had to go out and talk, people went out, walked with him outside where he talked, and then would come back in when he was done talking. And then during passing of the peace, people would go out of their way to make sure that they were shaking his hand, even though he wouldn't really look at them while they were extending their hand to shake. And so over time, especially even by Pentecost Sunday, it was clear that Antonio was beginning to change. But what was more important was not Antonio changing, but the congregation was changing. And that was such a deeply important lesson for me, because the dirty little secret in our church is that as much praise as we get in the city for being the only church that houses this program and lets all of these adults who've been sort of ghettoized into downtown San Jose have a place to be during the day, the dirty little secret is that we kind of wish they would just kind of go away, right? So that the nice demographic, right, the desired demographic, would feel comfortable staying in our congregation. And so we had to come to grips with our own, you know, complicitness in really supporting the stigma of mental illness and to get clear about who we were really going to throw down for. Because we had a very self-righteous attitude about this big action we were going to pull on Pentecost. We were going to talk to the man and tell the man we were going to get the money, and, you know, we were going to be these great justice people who exercised our power. We began to understand that, no, there's something bigger and deeper is happening here. And it's about us changing, as well as the systems and institutions around us being changed. And so when I talk about imagination, I'm talking about that. I'm talking about this notion of something that's bigger than just a policy win. PICO is praised, and we can raise money because we produce results and we deliver. But if that's all there is, we're just kind of tinkering around the edges. We're just sort of really kind of playing into the system of scarcity that Lynn was trying to help us understand. But if we understand that there's a much bigger vision, a much bigger crisis for us to address, that all of these other issues that we work on are just symptoms of, we have to begin to think about, what are we really trying to do? How are we really trying to grow? What are we really trying to be about as pastors, as congregations, and as communities? So I have been wrestling a lot with my clergy in the PICO network around what it means for us to have an imagination that's big enough. An imagination that's big enough to have moments like that, Antonio moments, where we discover something deeper about who we are and who we're called to be that's bigger than just a policy win or winning a campaign, but really about changing lives, changing communities, and even changing ourselves. So if we can go to the next slide. Next one. Actually, let me just stop and see if there's, I think I can entertain a couple of, no, I actually better keep going. So I want to talk about hope, and then we'll do the questions. I'm doing a little editing here. So when I talk about an imagination that's big enough, I've been talking with our clergy about this notion, about the notion of hope as an important sort of theological category for trying to talk about a prophetic imagination. We live in a time right now where, particularly in the aftermath of the economic downturn, congregations are paying a lot more attention to the economy, paying a lot more attention to their own place in the economy. We live in a time where, not just in spite of a man of color being in the White House, but even because of a man of color being in the White House, we are more aware of how we're sort of acting out around race and how we're really demonstrating a lot of anxiety that we have about race and the growing diversity in our country and the growing power that people of color seem to be building. And so we've been talking a bit with clergy about this sort of vicious cycle that we're in. Can we go to the next slide? Oh, okay. Let's go to the next slide. I'll come back to that. No, this is what I hate. I need to have control of my own slides. I like control. So we've been talking a bit about the cultural, economic, and policy changes that have been happening over the past really 40 years, 40, 50 years in our country, in some ways a reaction to the civil rights movement that has created the crisis that we face. Whether it's stagnating wages or increased family debt and growing income inequality, whether it's policy changes around regulation and cuts to education and infrastructure and mass incarceration and the depletion of unions, or whether it's been sort of the changes in our culture around people being more isolated and there being anxiety around race and anger over the political process and distrust of government. These all are like a vicious cycle that kind of feed on each other and have created a very deep crisis that I like to call really a spiritual crisis in the country. If we go to the next slide. And that this cycle is really driven by a dominant narrative that tells us that almost really what Lynn taught us in the previous hour, that we have to have, that there's not enough, that we have to have more, right? And that's just the way it is. And so then there's a dominant narrative that really feeds the vicious cycle of the crisis in our country, a narrative that places power outside of us. It's happening somewhere else. It's just the way it is, and nothing we can do about it. It's a narrative that creates and maintains and enforces social distance. It's a narrative that will target you and your community as the other and will scapegoat and shame you. It's a narrative that will orchestrate an us against the them world, and you are the them. And it's a narrative that will force you to make and hold positions and make choices that are often not in your best interest. So we talk about the kind of voting patterns that we have and what people are voting for and voting out of their own interests. Our clergy have been doing a lot of thinking and reflecting together around this moment and around this crisis, around the vicious cycle and the dominant narratives, and are really clear that we need to really cultivate powerful counter-narratives. And that if we're going to cultivate counter-narratives, we have to have huge imaginations. We have to have prophetic imaginations. And we have to have imaginations that are informed by hope. So now I want to go back a few slides to hope and just reflect on this quote from Augustine. One more. So from my sister Hope, here's the slide we were talking about last night. Augustine said that hope has two beautiful daughters, anger and courage. Anger at the way things are, and courage to see that they do not remain as they are. We've been doing a lot of reflection together in the PICO network about what hope looks like, how hope shows up, and how hope informs our imagination. And this particular quote has been helpful in trying to think about the notion of hope, because hope is more than optimism, right? And hope that's informed by her beautiful daughters, that's palpable hope. It's tangible hope. It's hope you can feel and experience and bear witness to in the world. In PICO's work, go to the next slide. In PICO's work, we talk about engaging people at the point of their pain. Now, that slide used to just say anger right there. It just said anger. And then we would get stalled in our trainings because people would want to tell us about how we're not supposed to be angry and that it's not very Christian to be angry. It's not very positive to be angry. And so some of us, like me, have tried to open up the language a bit and have talked about pain. But when you talk about the root word of anger, you're talking about grief and loss. And when you get people to tell their stories in the way that Valerie taught us to tell our stories, you are going to encounter anger. And that's actually a good thing. Because getting in touch with that grief, getting in touch with that loss, getting in touch with that anger and the pain, it's actually a resource for helping you live into a much more hope-filled vision and imagination of what could be. And so we're not afraid of anger in organizing because we think that anger is a resource, not for destruction, right, but for construction and for building. And then I love that Irshad has been with us talking about moral courage. Because when I think about courage, I think not only about doing the right thing even in the face of your fears, but I think about courage as being about the heart. And courage comes from people not just who are facing their fears and doing the right thing, but it comes from people whose hearts have been broken by oppression and injustice in the world and in their own lives. But their hearts have not just been broken, their hearts have been broken open so they can embrace others who are in pain. They can embrace a much more larger vision. So in our work, we've been talking quite a bit about what does it mean for us to be people who have hope-filled imaginations, who are engaging the anger, who are engaging the courage of our people, the people who live closest to the pain, and empowering them with the gifts, the skills, the knowledge to be able to make real change in their lives, real change in their families, real change in their communities. So I'm going to share one other quick story, and then I'm going to let you go. Valerie yesterday did a great job training us around storytelling. And as you see as you saw in the previous slide, the story of Self-Hustle Now is really another layer of what happens in the organizing process. I decided I would share with you the story that I wrote out from the exercise that Valerie went through. Let's go to the next few slides. One, keep going. That's a great quote. I'm not going to talk about that too much now.
Can you just stay there for just a second?
Sure. The greatest weapon in the hand of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. So this is Stephen Biko, the slain South African activist. Anybody seen the movie Cry Freedom? Largely about him and his story. And if we have more time, I would be getting into that around imagination. What does it mean for us to be living inside someone else's imagination? That's what this is. This is living inside someone else's imagination. What does it mean for us as people of faith to dream big and to actually cultivate imaginations that are bigger than the ones that we're living in? Is that helpful, Jackie?
Thank you.
That's my little speech on that slide. Okay. And then next slide. That's a great quote, but we'll skip that one. Next slide. Okay, so this picture is 23 years old. That's me on the left. It's my little brother in the middle. And my dad on the right. This is about 4 months before my father succumbed to cancer. We were at my cousin's wedding. My dad and I were groomsmen in that wedding. My father was a recovering alcoholic when he died, 9 years sober, sponsor, mentor to many, packed church house, even though he wasn't a church person, even though folks in the church that my mother took us to didn't know that she was married, that we had a dad, and didn't know who all these people were. Powerful, great man whose life story has inspired me. And I've grown and healed from a lot of the pain of the struggle in our relationship because of his alcoholism, even as I've reconciled with his spirit, because he's been gone for 23 years now. He inspires me quite a bit. And I do this work in some ways in tribute to him. And for the love of my little brother who he left me to finish raising. We go to the next slide. That's a picture a couple months ago, me and my son, Keenan, who looks a lot like my brother. We're wearing t-shirts with my brother's image on it. My brother took his life 7 months ago. And he committed suicide, and he was deeply depressed. He was struggling with the same kinds of addictions that our father struggled with, and could not see a way out, and made a very tragic decision. My work in organizing for a long time was driven by, of course, the witness of my own father, and the witness of my ancestors that I talked about at the beginning of the presentation. But organizing for me of late is really driven by a whole nother piece. In the sadness of what's happened to my brother, I'm mindful of what that means for the young man who looks just like him, who loved him as his favorite uncle, his only uncle, but his favorite uncle, my niece, My sister's girl had two uncles, and you know, the favorite one's gone, and now she has me, the serious one. That's how it goes. So this is what I've been reflecting on his death and how it informs my participation in this work. And I thought we might have time to, I don't think we do, to have you do some of the same. But these are the six sentences that I wrote, and they're long preacher sentences. So, but if you remember the exercise we had to answer six sentences, right? So I wrote here, I faced the tragic death of my brother to suicide in September 2013. I could have chosen to grieve this as a personal loss about the isolated action of one individual, but instead I chose to hold myself, my family, my community accountable for the pain of my brother and the pain-making systems that created and maintained his suffering. I learned that homicide and suicide among black and brown men are related. I learned that I must fight this fight for my son, my nephew, other boys and men of color. I learned that hope has two beautiful daughters. My story is the part of the story of millions of men of color who are just canaries in the mine, so that this story actually matters to all Americans impacted by addiction, mental illness, gun violence, who want to live free and full lives, lives of safety, opportunity, welcome, and fulfillment. We have an opportunity, like never before, to humanize the lives of millions and lay the foundation to build a truly inclusive vision of opportunity in this country. A first step would be to join the movement, to participate in PICO's Lifeline to Healings campaign through trainings around the country this spring and summer, to learn to tell stories and to learn to train thousands more to do the same and lay the groundwork for a powerful campaign in 2015 and 2016 that dismantles mass incarceration and reduces gun violence in our communities. Those are my six sentences. Organizing that's informed by a hope-filled imagination is essential. If we just want to win campaigns, we can do that. But if we want to change hearts and change lives and change communities, if we want to build a better world and cultivate the beloved community, we have to have a big imagination, one informed by and filled with hope. An imagination that is sustained, that is disciplined, and that is emancipating. And that's the hope that I want to be about.